Pain and fever became too much to bear. I asked God to lay his healing hands on me while I slept. Both times I awoke refreshed and well, without fever or pain. I had been cured by the power of his love. No, illness wasn't going to take me. I was certain that God had a greater purpose for me, and I prayed every day for him to reveal it to me. At first, I was expecting him to show me my entire future all at once, maybe with a flash of lightning and a clap of thunder thrown in for good measure. But I came to learn that God never shows us something we aren't ready to understand. Instead, he lets us see what we need to see when we need to see it. He'll wait until our eyes and hearts are open to him, and then, when we're ready, he will plant our feet on the path that's best for us. But it's up to us to do the walking. God put my feet on the right path while I was listening to Pastor Morinzi talk about the war one day. The pastor was excited because the United Nations was considering sending peacekeeping troops to Rwanda, which he thought might hasten an end to the war. The UN had pulled most of its soldiers out after 10 Belgian peacekeepers were murdered by Hutu soldiers on the first day of the genocide. In fact, every Western country had evacuated its citizens from Rwanda when the killing started, leaving Tutsis to face their fate alone. There had been virtually no outsiders in the country since the genocide began. That had sent a signal to our government that the world didn't care if it were committing genocide, and that the lives of Tutsis didn't matter, so the killing continued. Even the mere possibility of the UN sending new troops meant a lot. It could even stop the genocide. But the pastor said that there was a problem. The Tutsis in the RPF don't want the UN to send troops because they want to keep the war going. They think they can win the war and take over. They are so arrogant. They are demanding that if the UN does send troops, they had better be English-speaking troops. Such nerve! The pastor told us that most soldiers in the RPF had grown up in exile in Uganda, which was colonized by Britain, so they spoke English. This contrasted with Rwanda, which had been colonized by Belgium, where French was spoken. So in high school, many of us were taught French as a second language. The RPF would refuse to speak French, even if they knew how, Pastor Morinzi added. They claim that the French military trained the Interahamwe killers. They hate the French. If the RPF were to win the war, they would probably make us all speak English. God turned a light on in my brain. Actually, it was more like a cannon going off. At that moment, I was absolutely convinced that the RPF would win the war. This meant that I would meet English-speaking people after the genocide and would have to tell them what happened to us. I also had a premonition that I'd be working at the United Nations, where practically everybody spoke English. I suddenly knew with crystal clarity that I would spend the rest of my time in the bathroom learning the English language. I felt as if God had handed me the winning numbers to a big lottery. All I had to do was make sure that I was ready when the numbers were drawn. I had to prepare to meet my destiny. I knew that learning a completely foreign language would require many hours of study, which would force me to cut back on my prayers. I worried that this would give the devil the opportunity he'd been waiting for, to jump back into my head, fill me with fear and doubt, and drag me down into darkness and despair. I did the only thing I could. I asked God what to do. Dear God, you put this idea to learn English into my head, so you better help me keep the devil away while I study. Now please, show me how I'm supposed to learn a new language while I'm stuck in this bathroom. I didn't bother informing the other ladies about my study plans. They already thought I was soft in the head for praying the way I did. So I kept my dreams to myself. The next day, when the pastor brought us food, I asked him if he could lend me a French-English dictionary and any other books he might own written in English. He looked at me as though I'd just ordered a steak dinner. "I only want to occupy my mind a little. We've been staring at the walls for nearly 2 months, and we can't even talk to each other," I whispered. He shook his head, turning away as though he were dismissing a lunatic. "If I learn English, I'll be able to tell the UN peacekeepers after the war how bravely you acted to save our lives," I quickly added. Pastor Morinzi suddenly warmed up to the idea, promising to look through his collection. I was lucky. Very few Rwandans owned any English books, but the pastor found two, as well as a French-English dictionary. "But I don't have any English books for beginners, Immaculée. The books I do have would be very difficult for you," he said. I smiled up at him. I had no way of knowing how long the war would last, but I didn't intend to take baby steps. I wanted to make giant strides toward my new life. "That's okay, Pastor," I responded. "I don't want beginner books because I'm in a hurry. Please, bring me the biggest, most difficult English books you have." The pastor became quite enthusiastic about my plan, even telling me how I'd be able to recognize the UN peacekeepers. "They are the only soldiers who wear blue hats," he said, handing me the two thick English books and the dictionary. I opened them immediately, feasting my eyes on the exotic-looking words. I held the books like they were pieces of gold. I felt as though I'd been awarded a scholarship to a fancy American university. I took a deep breath and thanked God for answering my prayers and bringing me the tools I needed to learn English. Even though I'd be losing prayer time, I knew that God would be with me while I studied. He intended for me to learn this language, and I could feel the power of his intention coursing through me. I would not waste a minute of my time in self-pity or doubt. God had presented me with a gift, and my gift in return would be to make the most of his kindness. I opened the biggest book and began to read. I dedicated the rest of my stay in the bathroom to praying, meditating on God, and studying as hard as I could. I learned English one word at a time. I'd see a new term in the English book, then use the dictionary to translate it into French and unlock its meaning. It was slow going at first, but it was fascinating and fun. The first thing I did was memorize the important words I knew I'd need as soon as I was back in the real world. I discovered that I meant je in French, and realized that it was a very important word for me to remember. I needed to be able to say, "I am Tutsi. I need help. I have been in hiding. I am looking for my family," or "I want a job." At the end of my first day of studying English, I'd read the first page of the first book many times. I wish I could remember the name of the work now, or even what it was about, but it's a blur. What I do remember is holding it tightly to my chest when it became too dark to read and silently mouthing my first English sentence. "I am Immaculée. Thank you, God." At the end of each day, I was exhausted but exhilarated. I knew that the new life God had planned for me would reveal itself in this language I couldn't yet understand. As the days passed, I memorized many of the terms I'd need to tell my story in English. Escape, hiding, war, prayer, job, and God became the cornerstones of my growing English vocabulary, and each new word was as precious as a jewel. I also committed the words before and after to my memory, because by then I knew that I'd always refer to my life in terms of before or after the Holocaust. While browsing the dictionary one morning, I discovered a section on English grammar. Rules! I was ecstatic. I'd found the keys that would unlock the mystery of English. Verbs, nouns, and adjectives. Conjugation, past, present, and future. It was wonderful. While the other ladies slept or stared into space, I explored a new universe. I said my prayers and read my books all day. I read until well past midnight beneath the faint light from the window, and I read until my eyes refused to stay open. And I thanked God for every second He granted me to study. 3 weeks after I started this endeavor, I'd already read the 2 books that the pastor had given me from cover to cover. I was ready to move on to the next level, to teach myself to write in English. I borrowed a pen and paper from the pastor and began composing a letter. I wrote to a man who didn't exist yet, but who was someone I believed in with all my heart, our rescuer. I was so convinced that we'd be rescued that I gave my imaginary hero all sorts of features and characteristics to make our future meeting seem more real. He was a tall, dark-skinned UN soldier with a small mustache and a thick British accent. He wore a clean, freshly pressed blue uniform with a blue beret pulled tightly down toward his right ear. He had a kind, open face, an honest smile, and warm brown eyes that filled with tears of compassion when he read my letter describing our tale of hardship. The image I had of him was exactly the opposite of one I had formed of the killers. Writing that letter was an important step for me in developing my new outlook on life. In my mind, I painted my rescuer as kind and caring, because that was the kind of person I wanted to come rescue us. Someone had once told me that it was important to visualize what you want to happen in the future, because doing so could actually help make it come true. Well, thanks to God, I'd become a big believer in that philosophy. God had planted a seed in my mind. He told me to learn English, and that practice was showing me that a rich and exciting life was waiting for me on the other side of the genocide. I knew that whatever I envisioned would come to pass if I had faith and visualized it with a pure heart and good intentions, and if it was something God thought right for me. It was then that I realized I could dream and visualize my destiny. And I would only dream for beautiful things like love, health, and peace, because that is the kind of beauty God wants for all His children. Chapter 15, Unlikely Saviors. The first really good news I had in a while came when the killings were at their worst and evil deeds had become the norm. Sembeba was talking to some friends beneath the bathroom window. They were discussing recent killings in the neighborhood that they'd witnessed or had been told about firsthand, and the atrocities they described were among the worst I'd heard. I thought I was going to vomit, as one of the boys described unimaginable wickedness, as casually as if he were talking about a soccer game. "They grabbed one mama, and all of them took turns with her. She was begging for them to take her children away, but they held her husband and her 3 little kids with machetes at their throats. They made them all watch while 8 or 9 of them raped her. When they finished with her, they killed the whole family." I cradled my head as they swapped horror stories. They talked about children who were deliberately left alive to suffer after their limbs had been chopped off, infants who were dashed against rocks, and HIV-positive soldiers being ordered to rape teenage girls to infect them with their disease. There was so much more, but I covered my ears and silently pleaded, "Oh God, if this is what is waiting for us, please take me into your loving arms now. Let me live in paradise with you, not in the hell this country has become." Eventually, the conversation outside turned from the crimes of war to the war itself. Some of the boys said that the government soldiers were getting beaten so badly that Kigali might soon fall to the rebels. They were all worried about what would happen to the Hutus if the rebels won the war. Sembeba said he'd heard that France was sending troops to Rwanda. He and his friends all sounded relieved because France had very close ties with the Hutu government. The boys seemed to think that the French would help the government troops fight the rebel Tutsis and drive the RPF out of our country. If that were the case, the war would end, and the killers could complete their evil mission in no time. If the French came to Rwanda, the rest of the world would be watching them. The world would see the killings, the massacres, and the rapes. And if the people in the rich countries saw, really saw what was happening with their own eyes, they'd have to do something. They'd have to stop the genocide. Wouldn't they? I prayed for the safe arrival of the troops and thanked God for sending them to us. It was true that, given their history in our country, the French were unlikely saviors. But one thing I'd come to embrace while in the bathroom was that God really did move in mysterious ways. A few days later, we heard a radio report about Operation Turquoise, which was France's plan to send troops to Rwanda. Soldiers from several French-speaking countries would be setting up camp near Lake Kivu, which wasn't that far from us. Hutu officials threw a big welcoming ceremony at the airport when the troops landed in Goma, which is near the Rwandan border in the neighboring country of Zaire. The pastor informed us that the ceremony proved the French came to Rwanda to kill Tutsis, but I didn't agree. I was sure that God was once again answering my prayers, this time by sending someone to rescue us. The United Nations had thrown its support behind the French plan, which was a good sign. And soon after they arrived, the French themselves announced their intentions on the radio. They said that they were in Rwanda to set up safe havens for Tutsi survivors. If Tutsis could reach their camps, the French soldiers would protect them. "Thank you, God," I whispered. A few days later, a French helicopter started circling our area. We were sure that they were looking for survivors, for us, and our hearts soared. From radio reports, I knew that the French were still too far away for us to reach them, and since the war wasn't over, thousands of armed killers still roamed the countryside hunting Tutsis. But it was clear to me what we had to do. The next time Pastor Morinzi brought us our table scraps, I spoke up. "I think that we should go stay with the French soldiers," I informed him. "That is a bad idea, Immaculée. You shouldn't believe that they are here to help Tutsis. They would probably kill you as soon as they saw you," he said, dismissing me with a wave of his hand. "The French will save us or they will kill us. Either way, Pastor, I think we'd like to take our chances with them." He let out a long sigh and shrugged his shoulders. He actually looked relieved by our request. The man had many more people living with him now than at the beginning of the war, and sheltering us was a constant worry for him. "If going to the French is what you all want, I'll find out where they are and see if it is possible to take you there," he finally consented. "But I wouldn't get your hopes up too high. It is still very dangerous outside. A Tutsi seen on the road will be killed instantly." Pastor Morinzi was worried. He was afraid that 3 months of confinement in his little bathroom had addled our minds, so he decided that he had to stimulate them. One night, while we were waiting for news about the location of the French troops, he came to us with a surprise invitation to join him in the main house for a visit. And not just any visit, he invited us to the movies. In the wee hours of the night, when everyone else in the house was sound asleep, the pastor led us down the hallway to an empty bedroom where he'd set up a TV and video machine. He shushed us along the way because of the noise we were making. After months of sitting, our legs were wobbly and we kept bumping into the walls. Nevertheless, I was very grateful to the pastor for giving us a respite from the bathroom, and we were all smiling from ear to ear. The pastor was worried that we might be overheard, so we watched the video with the volume turned off. Unfortunately, the pleasure of our movie night was short-lived. One of the pastor's houseboys had been outside and had seen the blue light of the TV flickering in the window of what he knew should have been an empty room. Hoping for a reward, he reported what he'd seen to a group of killers and told them that he long suspected that Pastor Morenzi was hiding Tutsis somewhere in the house. A friend of the pastor warned him that a very large group of killers was preparing to search his home. He told the pastor that they thought he'd been lying to them for weeks and were very angry. When the pastor came to tell us what had happened, he looked very nervous. I'd never seen him so scared. He dropped onto his knees and, for the first time since we'd arrived, clasped his hands together and prayed for our souls. Dear God, if it is time for these ladies to go to you, please take them quickly. I didn't find his prayer at all comforting. He'd frightened us more than we'd ever been, if that was even possible. I whispered, Pastor, do you think that the houseboy saw us go back to the bathroom after the movie? Do you really think that they know exactly where we are? I'm not sure what they know, but we'll find out soon enough. The killers are on their way. If they know about the bathroom and find you here, they'll kill us all. Chapter 16, Keeping the Faith. I heard the killers call my name. A jolt of terror shot through me and I was thrown completely off guard. Why did they call out my name? How did they know I was here? Were they coming to the bathroom? I tried to call on God, but all I could hear was the negative voice blaring in my mind, along with the vicious, sadistic chants of the killers echoing through the house. Clothes soaked in sweat, I fumbled with my faith. There were hundreds of them this time. They were yelling at the pastor, accusing and threatening him. Where is she? They taunted. We know she's here somewhere. Find her. Find Immaculée. They were in the pastor's bedroom, right on the other side of the wall. Less than an inch of plaster and wood separated us. Their footsteps shook the house, and I could hear their machetes and spears scraping along the walls. In the chaos, I recognized the voice of a family friend. I have killed 399 cockroaches, he boasted. Immaculée will make 400. It's a good number to kill. As I cowered in the corner, the devil was laughing at me. They know your name. They know you're here. Where is your God now? The killers were pressuring the pastor. Where are the Tutsis? You know what we'll do if we find them. Where is she, Pastor? Where is Immaculée? This is the last place she was seen. Where are you hiding her? My spirit tumbled back into the arms of fear and doubt, and I was even more frightened than I'd been the first time the killers came. Their voices clawed at my flesh, and I felt like I was lying on a bed of burning coals. A sweeping wave of pain engulfed my body, and 1,000 invisible needles stabbed my flesh. Yet I tried again to pray. Dear God, forgive me for my lapse of faith. I trust in you, God. I know that you will save us. You are stronger than the evil in this house. The killers were in the room where we'd watched the movie, overturning the furniture and calling out my name again and again. We want Immaculée! It's time to kill Immaculée! I covered my ears, wishing that I had one of their machetes so that I could cut them off to stop from hearing. Oh, God! I began to pray out loud, but couldn't form any other words. I tried to swallow, but my throat closed up. I had no saliva, and my mouth was drier than sand. I closed my eyes and prayed that I'd disappear, but the voices grew louder. I knew that they would show no mercy and my mind echoed with only one thought. If they catch me, they will kill me. If they catch me, they will kill me. I put the Bible in my mouth and clenched it tightly between my teeth. I wanted to swallow God's words, to gulp them down into my soul. I wanted to find his strength again, but the negative spirit that had haunted me for so long was planting horrid images in my mind. I saw what the killers would do to me when they found us. I saw the torture, the humiliation, the murder. Oh, God, please! I screamed silently. Why do you want me to go through this? Why? What else can I do to show you my love? I want to believe that you will save us, God. How can I have more faith? I'm praying so hard, God, so hard. But they're so close, and I'm so tired. Oh, God. I'm so tired. I felt faint. Consciousness slipped away from me until the killers' thundering voices were only a soft, distant rumble. Then I was sleeping and dreaming a sweet dream of Jesus. I floated like a feather above the other women. I saw them trembling below me on the floor, holding their Bibles on their heads, begging God for mercy. I looked up and saw Jesus hovering above me in a pool of golden light, and his arms were reaching toward me. I smiled, and the constant aches and pains that had become part of my body after weeks of crouching disappeared. There was no hunger, no thirst, and no fear. I was so peaceful, so happy. Then Jesus spoke. Mountains are moved with faith, Immaculée. But if faith were easy, all the mountains would be gone. Trust in me, and know that I will never leave you. Trust in me, and have no fear. Trust in me, and I will save you. I shall put my cross upon this door, and they will not reach you. Trust in me, and you shall live. Suddenly, I was back on the floor again with the others. Their eyes were still closed, but mine were wide open, staring at a giant cross of brilliant white light stretching from wall to wall in front of the bathroom door. As I looked, radiant energy brushed my face, warming my skin like the sun. I knew instinctively that a kind of divine force was emanating from the cross, which would repel the killers. I knew that we were protected and safe, so I jumped to my feet, feeling like I had the strength of a lioness. I thanked God for touching me with his love once again, and then I looked down at the others. For the first and last time while I was in the bathroom, I shouted at my companions, "We're safe, trust me! Everything is going to be okay." The loudness of my voice hit them like a slap in the face. They looked at me like I was a madwoman, and then they reached up and pulled me down to the floor. I smiled, even though I could no longer see the cross on the door. I knew it was there. The killers had already left the house, and I heard them singing as they walked away. The pastor came to see us later that night. "They went straight to where I'd shown you the movie," he explained. "They tore the room apart. When they found nothing, they almost tore the houseboy apart. They apologized and left, but it isn't safe here for you anymore. I fired the houseboy. Now he's angry and suspicious. He's friends with the other servants, and I'm sure that they'll be all watching my every move from now on. so let's hope that the French soldiers arrive in our area soon. For the next week or so, we lived on tenderhooks. The killers visited again, turning Pastor Morinzi's bedroom upside down in their search for any sign that he was hiding Tutsis. And again, they promised to be back. The pastor was so worried he was being spied on that he cut back on the number of times he'd bring us food. We tried to joke that we'd found a sure way to escape the killers, starving to death, but hunger gnawed at us greatly. In early July, we heard one of the other houseboys knock on the bedroom door.
Pastor, it's been such a long time since I've gotten to the bathroom in there. Why don't I clean it for you now?
Our spines stiffened. Would this torture never end?
Don't worry about the bathroom, the pastor replied. I've cleaned it myself.
You shouldn't do that. That's my job. Let me in, and I'll scrub the bathroom good for you.
No. I've lost the key, so I'm not using the toilet in there. Now go away. I don't want to be disturbed.
Maybe I can open it without a key.
Go away. Didn't I just tell you that I don't want to be disturbed?
It was the first time in 3 months that someone had asked to clean the bathroom, so it seemed clear that the houseboy had figured out where we were hiding. We were beside ourselves with worry, certain that he'd go to the killers and tell them exactly where to search, the only room in the house they hadn't already looked. The pastor came to us after the houseboy left and said that he didn't think he'd go to the killers right away.
They almost killed the last houseboy when they didn't find Tutsis in the place he told them to look, he explained. So I think this one will wait until he has proof. He might not go to them today, but he will definitely go to them soon.
We looked at each other, knowing that we'd run out of time.
I heard this morning that the French soldiers are in the area looking for Tutsi survivors. I will talk to them today. Make sure that you're extra quiet while I'm gone, the pastor said, and hurried from the house.
As soon as he left, the houseboy began tormenting us. We could hear him moving around outside the bathroom window all afternoon. We knew that he was listening for voices or any movement, trying to confirm his suspicions before going to the killers. We didn't move a muscle for hours. At one point, he dragged a stool or table beneath the window and climbed up. We held our breath as he clambered up the wall, and we nearly fainted when his shadow appeared against the curtain. Thank God, the window was just beyond his reach, but he still stood there for the rest of the day, waiting and listening. Eventually, someone called him away, and we relaxed a bit, although I felt nauseated from the adrenaline that had been pumping through my bloodstream all day. The pastor returned that evening, but this time he brought good news, maybe the best I'd ever received.
I found the French soldiers, and I told them all about you. They're not far away from here, and they said to bring you to them very early tomorrow, between 2 and 3 o'clock in the morning.
We could hardly believe our ears. We were finally going to leave the bathroom.
Thank God,
we whispered simultaneously. The pastor immediately dampened our spirits.
Yes, thank God, he said. I just hope it isn't going to be too late for you. After I left the soldiers, I met a friend who told me that the killers are coming back to search my house. They will be here either tonight or tomorrow morning. Pray that it is tomorrow.
We prayed very hard. Pastor Morinzi came at 2 a.m. and told us to wait in his bedroom while he woke his children and told them about us. While we were waiting, we looked at ourselves in his bedroom mirror. It was the first time we'd seen our reflection since we arrived, and the shock almost killed us. We looked like the living dead. Our cheeks had collapsed, and our eyes were set so far back in their sockets that our heads looked like empty skulls.
Our rib cages jutted out, and our clothes hung from us as though they'd been draped over a broom handle. I'd weighed 115 pounds when I went into the bathroom. I was 65 pounds when I came out. We all wanted to cry. When the pastor returned with his 10 children, all of them quickly backed away. They were genuinely shocked and completely confused. The girls began crying. One of them even ran out of the room, yelling, "Ghosts! Tutsi ghosts! They've come back from the dead to kill us!" The pastor told her to keep quiet and settle down, and then he explained to them who we were. The pastor told his children to take a good look at us. "There, but for the grace of God, go any one of you," he reminded them. "If you have a chance to help unfortunates, like these ladies in times of trouble, make sure you do it, even if it means putting your own life at risk. This is how God wants us to live." My heart softened toward the pastor. Sure, there had been many times during the past few months I'd been furious with his behavior, and some of the things he'd said were insensitive, ignorant, and cruel. But he had risked everything for us, and he had saved our lives. As I stood there waiting to begin the next chapter of my life, I was very thankful. I asked God to watch over this man after we were gone. Shimwe, the pastor's daughter who had run out of the room when she first saw us, gave me a towel and one of her own pullovers to wear. She hugged me as hard as she could and told me that she'd pray for me. After so much isolation and deprivation, that moment of tender human contact moved me beyond words. The 8 of us said goodbye to the rest of the pastor's children, and then he led us away from the bathroom and into the fresh night air. Part 3, A New Path. Chapter 17, The Pain of Freedom. The sensations of the night overwhelmed me. The coolness of the air against my skin, the crispness in my lungs, and the brilliant, hypnotic beauty of the billions of stars dancing in my eyes made my soul sing out, "Praise God!" "What are you staring at? Let's go! We must leave now!" Pastor Morinzi said impatiently as I drank in my first taste of freedom. The pastor opened the gate, and his sons, with the exception of Sembeba, burst from the house carrying spears, knives, and clubs. They formed a tight circle around us as we passed through the gate, shielding us from the dangerous eyes of suspicious houseboys and malicious neighbors. And then we were in the open, walking quickly along the dirt road that had brought me to the bathroom 3 months earlier. We didn't see them coming. They appeared out of the night, coming over a small rise in the road. Perhaps 60 Interahamwe were marching in a double line, and while they weren't wearing their frightening uniforms, it was still a terrifying sight. They were heavily armed and moving fast, coming toward us, carrying machetes, guns, grenades, spears, and long butcher knives. One of them even had a bow and arrow. We passed by them so closely that I could smell their body odor and the alcohol on their breath. Remarkably, I was less afraid walking next to them than I'd been hiding from them in the bathroom. Still, I called on God to keep us safe and quell my fear. The ladies and I stayed in the center of our group escort with our heads down, hoping that the Interahamwe wouldn't notice that we were women. We passed without incident. A few of the killers even said hello and wished the pastor good luck as they went by. Either they assumed that we were fellow killers on a late-night hunt, or God had blinded them. I thought it was likely both. Besides, at this point in the genocide, they wouldn't have expected or believed that so many Tutsis could still be alive in one place. They had good reason to think that way, since there were dead bodies everywhere along the road. God had answered my prayer and taken away my fear of the killers, but apparently he hadn't extended the same blessing to Pastor Morenzi, who was visibly shaken by our encounter with the Interahamwe.
"You ladies will have to go on from here on your own," the pastor said. "The French are close by. Go ahead. We'll watch until you're out of sight."
I shook the pastor's hand quickly, and then he and his sons hurried from the road to hide in the bushes. The other women and I were now completely exposed and had no time to waste. The French camp was about 500 yards away, and we ran as fast as our weak legs would carry us. My heart was pounding when we reached the camp, which was set up on the grounds of an abandoned Protestant nunnery. The rest of the group huddled in front of the gate, looking very frightened, while I rattled it and called out as loudly as I could, "Please, help us! Please, we need help!" It had been so long since I'd spoken above a whisper that my throat ached from trying to shout. My voice was hoarse and so low that it was nearly inaudible. The ladies panicked when we saw no one waiting to save us, and they started to wail. A few seconds later, six or seven soldiers appeared on the other side of the fence with their machine guns trained on us. I shushed my companions, and because I was the only one who spoke French, I told the soldiers who we were and where we'd come from. The soldiers looked at us skeptically, and their guns were raised and ready.
"It's true. Everything I told you is true. We've been waiting for you to save us," I said desperately.
The smallest soldier in the group, a grim-looking, light-skinned man with a shaved head, came to the gate and shone a flashlight in our faces. It was obvious that he was inspecting the shape of our noses. The old myth was that Hutus had flat, broad noses, and Tutsi noses were long and narrow. Apparently, we passed the test because he opened the gate and let us in. However, he didn't lower his gun while asking to see our identity cards. I could hear the ladies breathing quicken. None of them had their identity cards, and they thought that the French were going to shoot them on the spot. Luckily, I'd put mine in my back pocket when I left home 3 months earlier. The soldier examined my card, which had the word Tutsi stamped across it, and then nodded in approval. I immediately vouched for the other women and told them,
"I think we're gonna be okay." An emotional dam burst in us as months of pent-up fear, frustration, and anxiety flooded from our souls, and a few of the ladies began to sob uncontrollably. The demeanor of the soldiers changed immediately. They lowered their weapons and spoke gently, their voices filled with kindness and concern. We were given water and cheese, the first palatable food we'd seen in months. We ate greedily, realizing that the French were not going to kill us, as the pastor had predicted. I translated for the others. "It's all right, ladies," the small soldier said. "Your nightmare is over. We won't let anyone hurt you. Do you understand? You're safe now. We're going to take care of you." Soon we were all crying. It seemed impossible that it was over, but here we were, surrounded by trained soldiers with big guns who were promising never to let the killers get near us again. When we settled down, our rescuers explained that we were in a field encampment and that they'd radio for a truck to transfer us to their base camp 10 miles away. They told us that we should get some sleep while we waited. I wandered away from the others, feeling a desperate need for something I'd been missing for so long, a moment of privacy. I lay down on the ground, absorbing everything around me, the rocks digging into my back, the damp earth in my fingers, the dried leaves scratching my cheek, and the sounds of animals scurrying through the darkness. I was alive, and it felt wonderful. I closed my eyes and told God that it was up to Him to find me a new road to travel.
I shivered. The cool air brought goosebumps to my skin, reminding me that I was no longer in the cramped, humid bathroom. I stood up, stretched toward the sky, and then walked about the camp. I was completely unafraid, even when I stumbled across a man sitting in the shadows. I startled him, and he jumped to his feet. After a second, he cried,
"Immaculée, is it you?"
It was Jean-Paul, a good pal of my brother's. I wanted to laugh and cry at how wonderful it was to be talking out loud to a friend again. We sat down and exchanged stories. I told him where I'd been and described my time at the pastor's. And he told me that the genocide had died down a bit in the north since Kigali had fallen, but it was still very bad in Kabuye province, where we were. "Kigali has fallen?" I asked, shocked and delighted.
"Yes, but there's still plenty of killing," he replied. "In fact, around here it's even worse than before. The worse the war goes for them, the more vicious they become. They're getting frustrated, too. They've slaughtered so many Tutsis already that they're having a hard time finding more of us to murder. The killers came a week after the president's plane was shot down. I was visiting my friend Loha, a Hutu who lived a few houses away, when I heard them arrive at my parents' home. I saw about 300 killers, mostly neighbors and old family friends. They broke through the front door and chopped up everybody. All my brothers, my four sisters, my mom and my dad. They killed everyone."
I told Jean-Paul that I would pray for his family. Then I realized that he probably knew what had happened to my parents and brothers, since he'd been in the area throughout the genocide. The question was, did I want to know what had happened to them? Was I strong enough to take it? If I knew for certain that they were dead, there would be no going back to my old self, my old life. I decided that it was better to face the truth. I'd have to pretend that I already knew my family was dead. Otherwise, Jean-Paul would try to spare my feelings and tell me nothing. I'd have to trick him into telling me what I needed to know. I reached into my pocket for my father's red and white rosary and asked God to give me strength. "So, Jean-Paul, about my father. I know they killed him. I just don't know where. I was wondering if you might know any details."
"Oh, yeah. I know everything. They killed your father in Kabuye town."
His words pierced my heart like a spear. I pushed my fists into my eyes and turned my face to hide my tears.
"Your dad was killed a day or two after my parents were murdered," Jean-Paul went on. "I think it was on April 14th. He'd gone to the government office to ask the prefect to send food to the stadium because there were thousands of refugees there who hadn't eaten for days. That was a big mistake."
My eyes were burning and my stomach ached as Jean-Paul continued. "The prefect called your father a fool and had his soldiers drag him outside. They shot him on the steps of the government office and left his body in the street."
"I see. Thanks for telling me all this, Jean-Paul."
"It helps," I said, using all my energy to steady my voice. I thanked God for the darkness hiding my face. "And what about my mom? I know she was killed too, but I don't know how."
"Oh, Rose," he broke in. "She was murdered a few days before your father. She was hiding in the yard of your grandmother's neighbor. Someone was being killed nearby, and your mom heard the screaming and thought it was your brother. She went running into the road shouting, 'Don't kill my child! Don't kill my Damascene!' It wasn't Damascene. But as soon as the killers saw your mom, they went after her. They told her that if she gave them money, they'd leave her alone. She agreed and went to borrow some from her friend, Murenge.
but Merengue ordered her to leave her alone. Get away from my house. We don't help cockroaches here. Merengue told the killers to take your mother into the street to kill her, because she didn't want them messing up her yard. They dragged your poor mom to the side of the road and choked her to death. Every word he told me was torture, but I was a prisoner to the information. I pushed him to tell me more. Did you happen to hear about my little brother, Vianney? I asked, feeling a stab of guilt as I remembered how I'd sent my baby brother away from the pastor's house in the middle of the night. Vianney was killed at the Kibuye Stadium. There were thousands of people there, and they were all annihilated. First, the killers shot them with machine guns, and then they threw grenades at them. I don't think anybody survived. My hands were shaking, and I was having a hard time getting air into my lungs. I calmed myself as best I could and tried to ask about Damasin, but I couldn't bring myself to say his name. I clung to the hope that he was alive and waiting for me somewhere. Finally, I said, my brother Imable is in Senegal and doesn't know any of this. I don't even have an address where I could send him a letter. You should ask Damasin's friend Bon. I know he has all of Damasin's papers and things, or at least he used to. Why is that? I asked, my heart racing. Because he was hiding your brother, and when Damasin left to go to Zaire, he left all his stuff with Bon. But he might have gotten rid of things by now. I heard he went mad after your brother was killed. The words struck me.